Sick Boy Podcast is a health and comedy show about what it's like to be sick. Wait, is that right? How can illness be funny?
You'd be surprised.
Okay. Sick Boy is hosted by
me, Brian Stever.
And me, Taylor McGilvery.
And myself, Jeremy Saunders.
Come on in and join us to melt your heart, learn something fascinating, and bust a belly laugh. Trust us, you'll be glad you did.
You can find Sick Boy on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your pods.
This is a CBC podcast.
I'm Alamin Abdul-Mahmoud, and this is Commotion. Listen, this week, 30 years ago, Kurt Cobain died. Kurt pushed the boundaries of what it means to be an artist. Today, we talk about his legacy. But before we do that, before we get into it, why don't we give him the first word?
What else should I be?
I think it's fair to say, if you came of age in the 90s, you might note April 8th, 1994, as one of those generation-defining where-were-you moments. That was the day that Kurt Cobain was found dead in his Seattle home. It's 3 days after he died by suicide. Kurt was the lead singer of Nirvana, and he changed the rules for how a mainstream rock band could sound and the kinds of things that they could express. Yes, Nirvana pushed rock into a more raw, more grungy direction, but Kurt himself was outspoken about mental health, about feminism, about queer rights, in ways that few rock stars before him were. What's so amazing to me is now, 30 years after his death, Kurt Cobain remains as influential as ever. Of course, you hear that in alternative rock, but it turns up in hip-hop, it turns up in jazz, it turns up in pop music. And to talk about all of this, we've got music journalist Susie Exposito here and Nirvana biographer Michael Azarad. Michael, Susie, welcome to the show. Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm grateful. Good
morning.
I'm grateful that you guys are both here. Michael, I'm going to start with you. Look, a lot of Nirvana's impact had to do with their timing, right? This was a band at the dawn of the 90s pushing back against a couple of excesses. The excess of pop in the 80s, the excess of hair metal of the previous decade. And it gave us something that just felt a little bit more raw, a little bit more real. 30 years later, that context, that particular context that birthed Nirvana is not exactly directly relevant. You know, a kid listening to them today might not have a frame of reference for, oh, this is what Nirvana were kind of reacting against. So what is it about their music, you think, that still resonates in the streaming age where they still generate, you know, billions of streams?
Yeah. Well, you know, that lack of context is why I wrote a new edition, an annotated version of my Nirvana biography.
Yeah.
And it's called The Amplified Come As You Are. And so, yes, in that time, there were things like Heroin Chic and Selling Out.
Yes.
And Latchkey Kids, Slackers, Republican Moral Panics.
Every word you just said is very 90s, you know, very like transporting back 30 years, just you saying those words. Yes, 100%.
Yes. So, yeah. You know, I part of why I wrote that book was to establish that context for people who were too young to remember things like that.
Yeah.
As far as a continuing relevance for Nirvana, a few things. One, we live in a very fake time. There's fake news, fake photographs, fake music, fake food.
Mm.
And there are always going to be some people who yearn for something real. And that's what Nirvana embodied. Mm. And that was their whole thing, to be passionate and genuine. It's still catchy music. Those are still great songs, and people will always react to great songs.
Yeah. Sorry, I think, Michael, you got cut off there. I can no longer hear you if you can hear me. But so let me
can
just
you
ask
hear me
Susie.
Now?
I can hear you now, but let me just ask Susie this question here. Because, Susie, you were a bit too young to have experienced Nirvana in their moment. So what was it about their music for you that appealed to you once you got older? Because I feel like you were maybe four, you know, when Nevermind came out, or even younger.
No, I was like a toddler when Nevermind came out.
Okay,
I was born in 1989. And so I was about like I was 4 years old when Kurt passed away. But the crazy thing is that I do remember watching the coverage on MTV because my parents were like on the older end of Gen X. And they loved Nirvana.
Mm.
My dad bought me my first copy of Nevermind when I was 10. I think that's when I had finally graduated into like the big kid music. And so I played it on like a little Hello Kitty boombox that was pink. But my musical diet was very much influenced by Nirvana and Hole. I even dressed up as Courtney Love for Halloween in middle school.
Oh my God.
My mom amazing. Thought that was a problem. She was like, I'm worried about you. but I think what spoke to me was like the vulnerability in Kurt's lyrics and in his performances. He was, he served as like a gateway for a lot of men, especially to express themselves and make very like, just raw, and emotional music. So that it wasn't about partying. It wasn't about, I don't know, random stuff like
it was very pet. Internal music, right? It was for sort of like music that looked inward.
Yes. Yeah. And outward too, you know. Mm-hmm. he had his political commentary, his social commentary, but what made grunge so different was how intimate these men would get in their lyrics, like with their feelings. There were also so many interesting gender dynamics at play in grunge, and Kurt came out of a scene where women were very vocal and very visible. He, you know, felt a lot of solidarity with like the Riot Girl community, with the queer community. So yeah, that was my way in.
Michael, I think one of the interesting things about grunge was that that the Hair Farmer bands kind of looked feminine, but had really macho music. And grunge had, really macho sounding music, but rather feminine sentiments.
Oh, I see.
And that was a real flip flop, a really interesting time.
I want to get into the hype around Nirvana and how people talked about them, Michael, because there was so much hype around them and so much mythology and notoriety surrounding Kurt that it was, I think, like maybe easy to overlook that he was also just an incredible songwriter. As someone who spent a lot of time interviewing him back in the early 90s for your book, Come As You Are, how would you gauge his commitment to the craft of songwriting? How did he approach songwriting, would you say?
He approached songwriting really meticulously. If you look at his journals, you can see all the different versions of the lyrics he wrote, and you cross it out and change it. He would even write, you know, when he sings "yeah" in a song, it seems spontaneous, but he actually wrote it in the lyrics. And so he was very careful about the craft, and he came up with some really interesting chord changes and long melodies and stuff. It was pretty cool.
Yeah,
I visited one of their rehearsals for the In Utero tour, and I was listening to them, and they sounded great. But sometimes Kurt would stop them and, you know, give, you know, a little tip to like one of the guys in the band, just a very subtle change.
Yeah.
And then they'd start playing again, and all of a sudden it sounded killer, like really great. And he just had a really subtle, very refined sense of how he wanted things to sound. It sounds really rough and, you know, rough and tumble, but it actually was very meticulously planned out.
Just you describing the idea of like witnessing Nirvana in a sort of rehearsal kind of situation, it's like that. You have to understand that's a big deal to me. Like that's overwhelming to me when I hear you say that. Like that's the stuff of mythology and legend. So if you could just sort of make it a bit more real for maybe Susie and I, what was he like? What was he like as you sort of like dealt with him and talked to him?
Everyone paid, you know, direct attention to Kurt. He was calling the shots, you know. And you had, you know, three really formidable musicians there with Pat Smear, Dave Grohl, and Chris Novoselic. So these guys all know how to play, but they were listening to Kurt because he's the leader of the band, and those were Kurt's songs. And he had a very specific way he wanted things to turn out.
Susie, it's kind of just crazy to me to just hear somebody describe what it was like to hang out in a room with Kurt Cobain. I'm going to go process that later. But in the meantime, I want to play you guys a couple of clips. So in the wake of Nirvana blowing up in the early 90s, first, you heard a lot of sound-alike bands on the radio like this. We're We're gonna hear words from people who are gonna be like, "What do you mean sounded like bands?" But look, we said it. But also, more recently, you've heard Nirvana's influence popping up in places like this.
He's the one who likes all our pretty songs. Yeah. Looking for pain with my click in a bad bitch. Just call me Cobain. She can see the pain.
All right, so that was, in order, jazz artist Robert Glasper, country star Sturgill Simpson, rapper Lil Peep. And at the very end there, you heard pop star Halsey talking about being the new Americana, raised on Biggie and Nirvana. They're all covering or referencing Nirvana or Kurt Cobain in the lyrics. Susie, how do you account for Nirvana's appeal across genres and generations, do you think?
Well, it starts with, I think that Halsey song really sums it up perfectly. Mm. Like we grew up on Biggie and Nirvana. Sure. I think that's very true for the millennial generation in the US. You know, like I was a teen in the 2000s, but we grew up with a medley of sounds. Mm. I don't remember what it was like before MTV was able to curate stuff for me. Yeah. At least when I was much younger, and what people think of as like algorithmic listening now, we were doing a similar kind of listening in that it was curated. It was on TV. I would put on MTV in the morning just to watch the music videos while I got ready. And it felt like putting a playlist on shuffle. But also I feel like grunge was such an American tradition because it was distinctly, it reflected a specific time in the United States where there was a huge political shift and we're coming out of like the Reagan years, the senior Bush years. Mm-hmm. The religious right had like a really, they had a lot of power and they were struggling to maintain their power in the 90s. A lot of gender norms were changing. There was a lot of resistance bubbling up. I covered the Rock for Choice concerts of the 90s. I wrote a history about it for the LA Times. And rock was very essential to these, resistance movements. Mm-hmm. Bikini Kill was a huge influence on Kurt. He was very much embedded in that scene. So a lot of these ideas and a lot of this spirit of resistance, it trickled down to us younger generations.
Yeah. Michael, something that I find overwhelming quite often is like walking down the street and seeing people with Nirvana shirts. And I go, has it become a clothing brand? Did I miss that particular memo? I don't understand how this iconography has kind of become everywhere. But to me, when I see that iconography, I wonder if the conversations that Nirvana started are still present right now and in the ways that people are sort of talking. And specifically what I mean here is like I want to talk a little bit about Kurt Cobain, dying by suicide in 1994. It was like this big cultural conversation about suicide, about mental health. How do you feel our understanding of his death and that moment and the idea of like an artist's mental health in general has evolved since then? Because I find it so, it's kind of like disorienting to see this iconography everywhere and go, do you guys understand all the ways that, this conversation unfolded back in the 90s and the early 2000s? And I don't know if they do.
I'll be glad to answer that. I'd like to pick up on an earlier thought about, Nirvana's enduring influence in today's, musicians. A lot of people have covered Nirvana songs, but I think it's way more interesting that about people who were inspired by Nirvana, who make music that doesn't sound like Nirvana.
Right.
Like Lana Del Rey, Lil Wayne, Kid Cudi, Tyondi Braxton, the composer, Post Malone, that's a really powerful thing. It's way more interesting than people who sound like Nirvana or cover Nirvana songs.
Yeah, I think that's true.
And I think that is the lasting influence. Make music that's true to yourself and, passionate.
Mm-hmm. I love that phrasing. But okay, continue. Sorry, go ahead.
And as far as the t-shirts, it's interesting. It is funny. Like I don't want to be the person who runs after the person wearing a Nirvana t-shirt and says, name three songs.
quiz.
Yeah. But I think they pick up on that logo as something that signifies rebellion, nonconformity or something like that. And that's maybe as far as it goes, but other people, love the music. As far as Kurt opening up that dialogue about mental health, I mean, yes, that was huge. Mm-hmm. People started, picking up. He would mention bipolar, syndrome or, depression and things like that. And yeah. It opened up a dialogue. Mm-hmm. Ever since then, there's addiction has been termed a disease of despair, which is a really compassionate way of thinking about it, which was not true in the early 90s.
Yes.
But now you have rock, huge people like Adele, Charlie XCX, Billie Eilish. Ariana Grande talking about their mental health, Bruce Springsteen, mm-hmm. That I guarantee that would not have happened in the early 90s. And it's happening now. And I think it's great.
Susie, last word to you on this. We got maybe about a minute left. What do you make of the way that we talk about mental health now after Kurt?
I think, to go off what Michael was saying, I think there's less stigma today, Like you have Selena Gomez, who's like one of the most ubiquitous pop stars in the world, being able to talk about having bipolar disorder. Mm-hmm. And like, I think it was a little more, I think it was more taboo back then, or it was part of like the weird tortured artist trope where, if you were to say, like, a lot of great art was made about having these conditions, but it was exoticized. Mm-hmm. Now we're really humanizing people who live with mental illness or any kind of mental health struggles. And I think that said, in this era of like therapy pop, where everyone talks about healing, we also live in an era of oversharing. Yeah. I wish I knew a little less about today's pop stars, to be honest.
I know.
But I think that's, it's happening because of how many beloved artists we've also lost, to mental illness, to addiction. That's very present in today's culture. And I think it's good that people are more transparent about what they're going through.
I think are way more aware of the consequences of fame and the pressure that they place on celebrities and the people that they love. So that's also a really huge development.
We got to leave it there, but I appreciate your time, both of you. Susie Esposito, Michael Azarad, thank you for your time. Thank you so much, you guys.
Thanks.
Pleasure. Susie Esposito is a writer based in Los Angeles, and Michael Azarad is the author of The Amplified, Come As You Are. He was in New York.
Think of your favorite one-hit wonder.
Or that overpriced toy your parents would never let you have.
Or that TV show that no one else remembers because it was canceled way too soon. Now, what if we could fix it? I'm Francesca Ramsey.
And I'm DeLon Grant. And after 20 years of friendship, we are now hosting a new nostalgia podcast called Let Me Fix It.
Each episode, we'll dig into our favorite celebrities, shows, and brands of yesteryear, and then imagine what it would take to repackage them for relevance today.
Think of our show as an intervention, but with way less stakes.
So subscribe to Let Me Fix It wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
I'm Alamine Abdul-Mahmoud, and this is Commotion. You might know the director Robert Lepage for being one of the giants of Quebec's theater scene, but what you might not know is that he is a giant wrestling fan. And when I say giant, I mean the kind of fan who holds underground wrestling matches at his very own theater in Quebec City. Now he's taking his passion a step further. He's got an exhibit at the Museum of Civilization in Quebec about the history of wrestling in that province. It's a show called Slam that he created with the circus company Flip Fabrique. Dominique Tardif is a reporter with La Presse. He's seen the show and the exhibit, and he spent a day talking with Robert Lepage. Here's our conversation. Dominique, welcome to the show, buddy. How's it going?
Great. I'm glad to be able to talk about wrestling with you.
Well, listen, I don't get enough people talking to me about wrestling enough, so I'm happy that you're here. I mean, look, you're not like a completely objective journalist who's like, oh, I don't know what's happening here, because you have some investment in this world. You started watching wrestling when you were 4 years old, so this must have been quite the interesting assignment for you to get.
Totally. Like, objectivity went right out of the window when I was asked to go to Quebec City to meet with Robert Lepage. Because, yes, I've been a wrestling fan for many, many years, since I was like 4 years old.
Yeah.
I totally fell in love with it. It was a huge part of my childhood. Went away for a while when I became an adult, because I was so self-serious and I thought that like wrestling was not smart enough, not serious enough.
We all go through that stage where we go like, oh, I'm a more serious adult now. I don't watch that wrestling stuff. Yes.
Exactly. But I came back to it. And now, I mean, it's not like I'm watching every hour of wrestling that is being shown on TV every week, because there's a lot of wrestling happening. Just if we're just talking about the WWE world, it's like maybe 6 or 7 hours every week.
It's quite a commitment.
Yeah, it's quite the commitment, but I'm still really into it, and it taps into some part of, like, I'm when I talk about wrestling, and you're gonna hear it for the minutes during our conversation, I'm becoming a child again. So this is why it's so important to me, because it's important to still be tied to the children you were, I think.
That's what I get out of wrestling. You know, narratives that are as old as time of good versus evil. There's drama here that is like kind of core to childhood. And I think like if you're able to connect with that, then you get a lot out of the show. It looks like opera and theater, but also with bodies hitting each other. You know, like that's the thing that I get out of wrestling. Let's talk about the bunch of time that he spent with LaPage. When we describe him as a wrestling fan, how deep is his relationship with wrestling?
So he fell in love with wrestling after meeting a wrestler called Marco Estrada, who's really important for the wrestling community in Quebec City. So they were training at the same gym. And Robert Lepage tells how he was kind of scared of the man, because he's like, he's got a bunch of muscles, like he's really imposing man. And at some point, Marco Estrada asked Robert Lepage if he wanted to come to a wrestling gala. But Robert Lepage knew wrestling through his childhood, because like in the 60s, 70s in Quebec, wrestling was huge. Went there, totally fell in love with it. You can scream as much as you want during a wrestling gala, during a wrestling, it's, they're asking you to do it. This is how you have fun.
This is how you participate in this thing. Yeah, that's right.
Exactly. So he fell in love with that aspect, the participating aspect of wrestling, because this is how it was going at the theater back in the day. So before they built the fourth wall, is asking you to stay silent during a play. People were screaming at the actors on stage, like we do now when we go to a wrestling event. So this is the part he fell in love with at first. And like you were saying earlier, he's starting hosting wrestling gala at his own theater hall, Le Diamant, which is like the nicest theater hall you've seen in your whole life. It's really beautiful, but they will do wrestling event there. And it's also a way for Robert Lepage to bring people from different social classes that would not come
to the theater usually.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they come there to watch wrestling, and maybe they'll come back for another event, a theater event. And they also have, this is like a really funny thing, like they have this huge grand piano in the hall covered with gold. So Robert Lepage was like, people are going to put their beers on there during the wrestling event. I don't want that. So the idea he had to prevent that thing happening is to hire a piano player, and the piano player is wearing like the all classical piano player outfit, but he's playing Metallica songs and rock songs on the grand piano before the wrestling event.
So first of all,
tells you a lot about how he looks at those kind of events and he looks at wrestling.
That's a great solution. And that's how you figure that out. But also just the idea of like, here's like this fanciest theater in town, but then also every once in a while is going to play host to what you call a gala. A gala is, I'm gathering, just like a match, right? Like a sort of like an opportunity to sort of invite people to just like watch the match. You've called the exhibit this brilliant meditation on the role of wrestling in society and on the theatrical aspect of wrestling. When you say that, how so?
The exhibit tells the story of wrestling in Quebec.
Yeah.
So it starts at the end of the 19th century. When we get into the exhibit, we're in a barn, because this is how wrestling was born. And this is why the vocabulary we use to talk about wrestling, kayfabe, a baby face, heel, that vocabulary is tied to the carny world, the carnival world.
Unfortunately, Dominic, what you've just done is made me do the job of having to explain to people what a kayfabe is. Kayfabe is... Is the illusion of reality that you're watching when you're watching wrestling. You're sort of like, these are the events that they're asking you to accept as real, because we know it's scripted, but also when you enter into this universe, like, this is the general setup. A babyface, that's a hero, you know? Like, that's the one that everybody is going to cheer for. What I didn't know, though, is the thing that you just said, which is the idea that this all kind of comes from the language of what were you talking about just now? Carnivals?
About the carnival world.
I didn't know that.
They would have strong men event, and they would ask, like, is there a man in this town that is stronger than this man? To prevent the strongman being beaten by some men that could be stronger than him in that very town, they would fix those events. Uh-huh. And this is how wrestling was born, through those kinds of contests.
Didn't even know that. Cool.
Robert Lepage, he uses a lot of mirrors in the exhibit in different ways. But the way I was reading it, I was looking at it like he was trying to tell us that in many cases, wrestlers are able to embody a truer version of themselves when they get into the ring. So like Ric Flair, who said many times that he doesn't really know now who's the real man and who's the character he becomes when he gets into the ring.
What I like about this is that, like, he is sort of drawing out, or is making you think about the fact that this is really about performance, right? Because the thing that we see most often when we think about wrestling is, like, maybe the body blows, or maybe the sort of the theatrical way of speaking. But from the way that you're describing this exhibit, he's sort of reminding you, this is a performance, and in order for the performance to land, the performers have to be good at it, you know? And in theater, these are actors whose job it is to sort of dissolve this illusion, you know, between you being like, oh, you're sitting in your seat and you're watching these actors. You forget that. You're like, oh, no, these people are really about to have a fight over these ideas. For Lepage, what makes a great wrestling match, would you say?
So I asked him this question, and of course he talks about all the physical aspect of wrestling, of course, because it's always mesmerizing to see those guys, those women and men do flips and all those crazy things in the ring. But the main thing for Robert Lepage that makes a great match is a great story. I mean, it's simple, but it's important. When you watch a great wrestling match, you suddenly forget that it's a put on, that you're watching a performance. You get into it and you choose you pick your side and you want your guy to win the match. We often say that in wrestling, the main character is the audience, which is true. But for Robert Lepage, the main character is the referee, because he embodies justice.
Yeah.
And this is one of the things that we see in wrestling. We see a reflection of how justice happens in our world, and most of the time in wrestling the referee is corrupt, or he's kind of blind to, he's oblivious to what's really happening in the ring. And I'm quoting Robert Lepage here. This is how justice works also in our society. Justice is oblivious to the real injustice in the world.
I'm really glad you brought up that point about the referee and the hopes of justice that we keep projecting onto them, knowing that they don't necessarily fulfill that, which leads me to this next conversation, because there's a room in the exhibit that is dedicated to the Montreal Screwjob.
Yes.
Look at this. Oh, you're kidding me. Michaels, are you going to try to beat Bret Hart with a sharpshooter? Yes, he is. Are you kidding me?
My mouth is agape once more.
Are you kidding me?
We got to talk about the Montreal Screwjob, but also, as you are about to say that, you reveal that you're currently wearing a Shawn Michaels shirt. Look, I think we got to talk about this particular moment in wrestling history. Could you explain what the Montreal Screwjob is and why it deserves its own room at this exhibit?
That's kind of a tough assignment for you to ask me to tell how that, like...
Bret the Hitman Hart was supposed to... Yes, you go ahead.
Canadian hero from Calgary, was supposed, so he was told before the match that was happening in Montreal, Survivor Series 1997, November, he was told that he was supposed to win the match. He was the champion at that point.
Yes.
He was told he was going to win the match against his archenemy, Shawn Michaels.
The heartbreak kid, Shawn Michaels.
A narcissist where Bret Hart is like this man of...
He's the man of the people. He's our guy.
He's the man of the people. Yeah. And he's got values, and they're important to him.
That's
so
great.
And wrestling is really important to him.
Yeah.
And he was robbed.
They fixed the match, Dominique. They fixed the match, and they screwed Bret the Hitman Hart out of it. So let's talk about the role, though, of why that deserves its own room in this exhibit.
When that thing happened, it kind of shattered in 1 second. It shattered the fourth wall because Vince McMahon came, the owner, ex-owner of WWE, came at the ring, and Bret Hart spat in his face.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody wrote about that event in the wrestling community.
Yes.
And after that, WWE had no choice but to admit in many ways that it was fixed. And this is how we were talking about kayfabe. This is how kayfabe died. So now if you're like 4 or 5 years old and you go to a wrestling event, maybe you buy into what's
being... You buy into the storytelling being told. Yeah. Yeah.
But people are asking me, or asking wrestling fans, like, but you know that it's fake, and we hate that. Don't use the F word in front of a wrestling fan.
We've known. We know. We're here for entertainment. Get out of here. You know what I mean?
We know, but we know it, and it plays into the pleasure, the fun that we have at the event. So there's part of my brain that totally knows it. Like when I go to the movies or when I go to the theater, I'm not constantly telling myself, those guys are going to have a beer after like kissing or hitting each other on stage. Now, it will not be like the best way to enjoy what I'm seeing on stage. So that's
in fact,
the same thing.
It would actively ruin it for you if you're like, they're not really driving those cars in the Fast and the Furious movies. I would like to believe that they are. Like, please leave me alone. This is a part of the entertainment that I get out of this thing.
So you have to suspend disbelief, but now in wrestling, in modern wrestling, they always play with the line.
That's right. Now they write that into the show so they can no longer distinguish what is real and what is not. And that's how like they've actually managed to maybe rebuild a part of kayfabe, if you will.
And this is why now we live in what we could call a post-kayfabe world.
I think that's exactly correct. I want to go back to a thing that you said before I got really excited to talk about the Montreal Screwjob, which honestly, we could talk about the Montreal Screwjob for an hour. I could talk about it for an hour. I don't know if many people want to hear us talk about that for an hour, but let me just go back to this idea of the referee as representing justice. You know, this idea of justice and good and bad, how does it connect with Quebec right now in particular?
I don't know how it would connect with Quebec right now, but it was connecting with Quebec back in the days, like in the maybe 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, because...
Sure.
Even though French Canadians are not a minority in Quebec, for many years they were treated as such.
Yeah.
So wrestling was a way, like hockey, because when the Montreal Canadiens were winning Stanley Cup.
But many Stanley Cups, yeah.
Yeah. It was a way for French Canadians to finally win at something. So
that's
Maurice
right.
Richard was our hero because he was the one who was finally winning at something. He was not badly treated by his boss in the shops, like it was the case with many French Canadians. And that was the same thing that was going on with wrestling. So there's a really famous wrestler called Yvon Robert, was famous during the 40s, 50s, 60s, was a really good friend of Maurice Richard and was as huge in Quebec.
Yeah.
But it was this massive hero for Quebec because he was winning in the ring against Anglos and against all over the world. And finally, French Canadians were good at something and were able to get a win.
So when you think about this now, what do you understand now about Robert Lepage as a theater director, having had this new and pretty intimate understanding of how much wrestling means to him, would you say?
Robert Lepage, he's this important intellectual, cultural figure in Quebec.
Yeah.
And we thought of him as somebody who's really serious because he's putting on like shows that can last 12 hours sometimes.
Yeah.
He's known internationally.
Serious as it gets when it comes to theater, right?
Yeah, like, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
So when a guy like him says, I'm into wrestling, this thing that a lot of people still think is dumb or too campy for how serious they think about themselves. It's huge for the wrestling community. So when I was there at the exhibit, it was the opening and there was a bunch of, maybe you remember Pierre-Carl Ouellette, who was wrestling, PCO was wrestling with Jacques Rougeau, the Quebecers in the 90s in WWF. Yeah. He was there and a bunch of important figures in the wrestling community in Quebec were there. And for those people, it's unbelievable that a museum as important as Musée de la Civilisation in Quebec will put on this whole exhibit.
Yeah.
That's really beautiful about that thing that for their whole life, they've been told is too dumb or like not really important, not culturally important for people who are deciding what's important culture for our province. So I think it's really important for Robert Lepage to talk about wrestling for those reasons, but also for him to deconstruct his image. So I had the chance to spend a day with him, and that man is really, really funny. And
he's not that serious all the time. Yeah.
No, no. So I think he likes the fact that now wrestling is part of the image we make, we get out of him, and that it kind of deconstruct the self-serious image that we can have of him.
I love that because you've just wrapped up so many ideas, ideas about the way that wrestling is viewed versus where wrestling really belongs. Because if you are a theater professional, let alone a theater professional with the reputation or the history of Lepage, then you go, my job is to create theater that makes people feel things and move them. And nowhere else do you see this as obviously and as directly as the theater that is created in wrestling. And so I appreciate you shedding light on this exhibit and also bringing your energy and your passion into this, because I truly feel, I'm like, I feel like we could talk about wrestling for another 3 hours, but maybe we should stop here, Dominique. But thank you for being here, man.
We should ask CBC to give us a whole show about wrestling.
I am so ready. Let's go. Anytime you want, let's do this. Dominique
Tardif. Let's call the boss.
I appreciate your time, man. Thank you so much.
Thanks for letting me.
Dominique Tardif is a reporter with La Presse. The wrestling exhibit that you just heard about is on until April 20th at the Museum of Civilization in Quebec. Also, if you speak French, you can hear Dominique's full conversation with Robert Lepage on his podcast, Juste Entre Toi et Moi. I also wanted to let you know that this Monday on Commotion, we are going to have like a blow-by-blow of The Rock's return to wrestling, because he's back at WrestleMania 40 this weekend. That is my best approximation of a wrestling voice. That's all you're going to get from me. Hey, I hope that you got a lot out of this conversation. I hope that I didn't reveal myself to be too much of a wrestling nerd. And if you talk to me about it in person, I will absolutely deny it. Listen, I will see you tomorrow. Thank you so much for hanging out with us. My name is El Amin. This is Commotion. Have a great day.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.